Welcome, this is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on this 15th of March 2012 here in Japan, still the 14th of March back on the west coast of the United States, where I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Kay, a psychologist who lives in Northern California and writes regularly on torture and other subjects for publications like Truthout, The Public Record, and Fire Dog Lake. He also has a personal blog, Invictus, and I will put the link to that in the show notes for this interview. And I'm glad to have you on the line once again, Dr. Kay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, James. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be talking with you.
Well, it's good to have you here to talk about the brand new report that's just out on Truthout just this month, recently released autopsy reports, Hayden Guantanamo Suicides Mystery, a very interesting report detailing some very troubling anomalies in the so-called suicides at Guantanamo. But before we get into the details of that, perhaps we can set the table and talk a little bit about the background to this story.
Sure. Well, the background probably begins even before the suicides of the two individuals I talk about, which were with the celebrated supposed suicides of three Guantanamo detainees in 2006. And that became the subject for an award-winning report by Scott Horton at Harper's, a number of reports by people at Seton Hall School of Law, and a plethora of different news articles over the controversy as to whether these particular individuals had in fact committed suicide or if they had been subject to experiments or killings at a secret CIA black site at Guantanamo that had been dubbed Camp No by some of the people who worked at Guantanamo. Subsequent to those suicides, there were three other suicides, the last of which was, in fact, in 2011. My article has to do with suicides number four and five, or supposed suicides. Those are of two prisoners, one Abdul Rahman al-Amri in May 2007, and Mohammed Ahmed Saleh al-Hanashi in June 2009. Unlike the 2006 suicides, which brought about a lawsuit for release of the investigation and the autopsy reports, very, very little was known except for what DOD, the Department of Defense, released initially after the deaths of al-Amri and al-Hanashi. Therefore, we knew very little about these deaths. But last year, as part of a FOIA lawsuit by the ACLU, a whole slew, over 1,000 pages, of documents were released about with numerous autopsies of detainees who had died in American custody. And buried deep within these, most of them, by the way, from Iraq, were the two autopsy reports relating to these two Guantanamo detainees. And apparently, I was the first person to look at them. So it was a bit of caprice, perhaps, involved in my finding these. What I found in them raised really serious questions about the circumstances surrounding their deaths.
Unfortunately so, and as you indicate, I mean, it's quite remarkable that that no one had picked up on this, but as you say, I mean, it came out in a release of 1,100 pages of documents, so obviously buried in there. But let's talk about some of those anomalies and some of the things that definitely indicate this was not a suicide, as it has been claimed.
Right. We'll start with the 2007 one, just work chronologically, of Abdul al-Amri. He was a Saudi Arabian, former member of the Saudi Arabian army, who was captured in 2002 and sent to Guantanamo, where he was held mostly in solitary confinement the entire time. He had never met with an attorney. In fact, so far as I know, none of the detainees, with the possible exception of the one who died last year, had ever met with an attorney. And al-Amri was held in solitary confinement at Camp 5 at Guantanamo, considered a place for troublemakers, where troublemakers were held. And he had been a longtime hunger striker, as were the 2006 suicides. And by the way, as we will see, so was al-Hanashi, the man who died in 2009. And he was discovered in his cell, according to the autopsy, hanging with a noose made out of, supposedly cut by a razor out of his bed sheets and tied to an air vent And he was also found with his hands tied behind his back with the use of the bed sheets. Well, there were a number of problems with all of that. One is that, and this is true for all of the suicides, number one, it is numerous sources, including what the DOD told me personally, is that every detainee at Guantanamo is within 3 or 4 minutes of being observed. It is standard protocol to check in on the cell of every detainee every 3 minutes or so. Some of these detainees, such as Ohanashi, were definitely under video surveillance as well, 24/7. Al-Amri was discovered with his hands behind his back, a fact that had never been told before to anybody. And he supposedly had cut his noose and rope out of his bed sheets, but there were two further problems with that, neither noted in the autopsy report. One was that prisoners like Al-Amri were not actually allowed access to a razor. So it's very difficult to understand how he got a razor. Insofar as prisoners at Guantanamo are allowed razors, they're very strictly regulated. They're only handed to them during their shower period, and then they are taken back from them at that time. So there's the question how he got that razor. Secondly, we discovered, and this has never been reported before, that the bed sheets used at Guantanamo were changed in when Mike Dunleavy took control at JTF 160, I think it was, in charge of interrogations, and changed the bed sheets out of fear of suicide attempts, and there were early suicide attempts reported at Guantanamo, to the kinds of bed sheets used in the federal prison system, which supposedly are non-tear, non-ripped bed sheets. I don't know how, you know, if they could be torn by a razor, but in any case, that wasn't reported as well. So there's a lot of questions about recently, by the way, and this is not in the Truth Out story, a testimony from another detainee is reported through a Guantanamo attorney who works for the detainees named Candace Gorman, indicated that Mr. Al-Amri had been quite ill. Of course, he had been on hunger strike, but he also was suffering reportedly from tuberculosis and hepatitis B and had been quite sick. But in the autopsy report, he's described as being in great health. One other odd fact I didn't go into is that unlike any of the other autopsy reports, for some reason, the autopsy examiners found it necessary to include a section of the autopsy report saying, subhead was evidence of physical abuse, excuse me, and they concluded there was no evidence of physical abuse. So why they put that in there, I don't know. But it certainly is odd, as if they wanted to make sure that people knew, whoever saw this document, that they had looked and there was no physical abuse. So the Al-Amri death remains kind of mysterious. His relatives felt that this had not been suicide at the time. They were in Saudi Arabia, and they asked the Saudi Arabian government to do something about it. And in fact, at that time, back in 2007, the Saudi Interior Ministry said that they would appoint a special medical committee to do an autopsy and prepare a report, which they would send to U.S. authorities. However, no one has ever seen such a report, and when I contacted the Saudi Interior Ministry as part of this article, they just would not return my inquiries.
Very troubling. And as you note in the report, I mean, there's just no way that this could really happen if they just upheld the standards of surveillance that they're supposed to. These prisoners are supposedly under constant video surveillance, someone checking on them every 3 to 5 minutes. And of course, they do have suicide watch for people they think are likely to do this. So all of those facts don't stack up with this story either.
Right. No, not at all. And there is one other that was personally to me a very odd little fact in the report. As there often is in autopsy reports, there was a toxicology section in which the Autopsy examiners do a toxicology re-examination from the fluids of the deceased, examining urine and blood. And what they reported it in the report that he, noting simply that he was tested for screened medications, parenthesis, including mefloquine, and drug, in parentheses, and drugs of abuse, and they didn't find anything in him. The reason this is odd is that they would single out that and make sure that the reader knew that he was tested for mefloquine. Well, what is mefloquine? Mefloquine is an anti-malarial drug, which Jason Leopold and I broke the story that it was, along with the researchers at Seton Hall, by the way, law school, that mefloquine was mass administered to all of the detainees when they arrived at Guantanamo. This supposedly was done as an anti-malaria measure, done at the behest or out of fear of the government of Cuba should malaria spread from these detainees coming into the facility. There were, out of the 500 plus detainees who had ever been at Guantanamo, only four of them actually ever had malaria. They, of course, they did come in with it. There is no malaria in Cuba. Al-Amri arrived in 2002. Presumably, he was also given mefloquine. But that was 5 years, more than 5 years, before he died. We wondered why mefloquine was ever given, of course, to all the detainees. And it's a very controversial drug that produces or can produce serious psychiatric and neurotoxic side effects. In fact, the U.S. government has recently stopped administering mefloquine to its own soldiers, and mefloquine within, use within the armed forces has been a matter of some controversy going back to the beginning of this century. So the question arises, why did they have to test him for mefloquine? Was mefloquine used, as we suspect, as for purposes of interrogation, to because it can cause in some individuals can actually bring about psychotic reactions? Is that what was happening to Al-Amri? We don't know. But I will say that, and this hasn't been printed yet either, that in my investigations ongoing on the mefloquine issue, that in a 1977 Senate hearing conducted by Senator Edward Kennedy, after the revelations about MK Ultra and secret testing of people at Edgewood Arsenal, et cetera, it was revealed by one of the CIA's doctors that they indeed had, MK Ultra had in fact done tests on anti-malarial drugs for interrogation. So, you know, there's a lot of red flags here. I don't have the smoking gun, but it certainly raises a lot of questions. And I should reveal here now that both in context of Al-Amri's death and Al-Hanashi's death, the UN Special Rapporteur on for extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions, Mr. Christoph Hines, has informed me that they are his office is going to look into the matter of these two detainees' deaths.
Extremely interesting. Well, has there been any other official response? This article's been out a couple of weeks now. Has there been any sort of U.S. DOD response to this? These charges?
No. There's been no response from DOD. When I was writing this article, I contacted them three times. Not only did they not tell me no comment, they refused to even get back to me on the subject.
I suppose no surprise, but absolutely, that's why I think we need to raise the level of awareness of this important article and the troubling issues that it raises, because of course, stepping back from just these two specific alleged suicides, of course, it raises the entire problem of Guantanamo itself and all of the information that continues to be blocked up behind bureaucratic walls about what's really going on there and who has access to the site. Can you talk a little bit about Guantanamo generally and the terrible abuses that have happened there because of this cover?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Guantanamo has variously been referred to as a concentration camp, a gulag. It was certainly and admittedly set up by the U.S. government as a place that could exist outside the law. In other words, a place where international and or even U.S. law could not, they thought, until the Supreme Court said otherwise, could not cover the men who came to that camp. The Bush administration, at the very beginning, made it quite clear that the prisoners brought to Guantanamo were not covered by the Geneva Conventions. And it was, in fact, in the Senate Armed Services Committee report, more than one high-ranking officer involved with the interrogations at Guantanamo referred to it as their, quote, experimental lab for interrogations. So it's obvious that it was set up not just to get intelligence, but to run experiments of some sort on interrogation and or other kinds of experiments on these detainees. Of course, many human rights associations or agencies have found Guantanamo to be wildly out of compliance with international norms. People are put into solitary confinement, and there are many, many reports of torture in Guantanamo. I referred in the article Truth Out to an earlier investigation I did that showed that forms of water torture and even some reports, anyway, of waterboarding had occurred at Guantanamo.
Absolutely, and unfortunately, it is just something that seems to never end. Of course, we had just 2 days after Obama took office the grand gesture of the signing of an executive order claiming to promise the closure of Guantanamo within 1 year. Of course, obviously, that never took place, and we saw that news kind of buried in sort of a summer doldrum where the New York Times sort of said, well, yes, of course, he did break his promise, and it's not closing, but it's just political wrangling and partisan politics, and it kind of got swept under the rug. What can you say about the sort of overall political awareness of this issue in the United States right now?
Well, unfortunately, Guantanamo seems to have been put on the very back burner. It is just not something that is often written about. Occasionally, it surfaces in the press as when the military commissions restarted, or if something big happens, like this last year with one of the detainees committed suicide, and or other stories occasionally, almost of a nonsensical sort, appear, such as the hubbub in the press after Carol Rosenberg at the Miami Herald revealed that the U.S. had built a $750,000 soccer field at Guantanamo, caused a huge uproar on the right about Obama wasting money, et cetera. But for the most part, it's as if the population doesn't know what to do, and the press, the mainstream press anyway, have totally dropped the ball when it comes to Guantanamo. Otherwise, why would I, a part-time blogging, want-to-be investigative journalist, whose primary job is a psychologist, be the person to discover these facts about two prominent deaths at Guantanamo? It means the press isn't doing their job. They don't care. And from my understanding, they've told other reporters that they're just not really going to pay much attention to Guantanamo. It's an old story. It's over.
Unfortunately, I think it just plays into that left-right political game far too well, with the left now not wanting to attack it under Obama and the right only caring about the soccer field and distractions like that. So unfortunately, it does just play directly into that. And of course, there is no profound outcry right now in the press. But given the absolutely outrageous things that we've seen coming down legislatively in the last year, including, of course, the signing into law of the NDAA and the ability of the U.S. government now for the president to basically use military assets on the people. Do you think there's a chance that people's overall awareness of the type of problems with military detention might actually be raised by some of these recent events and some of the egregious things we've seen coming out lately?
Do you mean the recent events in Afghanistan?
Well, the recent events in Afghanistan, the signing of the NDAA, the general awareness, the impeachment proceedings now against Obama.
I think, and you made the point very well, I think, just a minute ago, I don't think in this election year, I'm very, very sad to say, that these things will really get off the ground, that the liberals, the political class as a whole, are just immersed in the electoral politics, most of which is a joke. And certainly those who you might expect to take up these cudgels are holding their fire out of fear of embarrassing or damaging the Obama candidacy. And I think we're really subject to American electoral politics on this. But, you know, you never know, and stranger things have happened. It's unclear, you know, you never know what will turn the American electorate or populations politically. And it could be anything like one of these things. But I don't see a major uproar. You know, for those of us who spend a lot of time reading the political blogs, particularly on the left, you might think that the NDAA, for instance, is a tremendous issue that's just, you know, freaking everybody out. In fact, a number of states and politicians have, you know, made some political hay out of saying, well, we're not going to do anything in our state about that. But the truth is, state governments have nothing to do with the NDAA. And the population as a whole just appears to, outside of those perhaps supporting the Occupy movements around the country or, you know, writing comments on political blogs, it's just not clear that much is being done. And I do believe it is held hostage to the overall goal of the liberal political sectors of the country, who see it as their primary goal to reelect Barack Obama and or a Democratic Congress. That's how it is.
Well, that's, I mean, it's the saddest indictment of a society I can think of, but perhaps if P. Diddy or Kim Kardashian were to tweet out your article instead of the Kony 2012 video, we'd have a legion of millions of people who would actually care about Guantanamo again.
Right. Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, there's, and I'm not going to go into it because, one, I haven't investigated it personally, but I think there's a lot to be said for those who are pointing to the Kony video is a kind of, you know, as horrible as Kony is, and he's pretty awful, is a kind of psyop to kind of direct people's attention because, of course, it makes the U.S. look as if it is on the good guy's side, right? We're opposing these terrible people. But, meanwhile, you know, it's the same thing with the U.S. propaganda about, say, Syria. And endless stories lately about Syrian torture, et cetera. But the in Bahrain, somewhat to the south, on the Arabian Peninsula, where a crackdown of the Bahrainian government, along with the Saudi military help, and torture, including of doctors, and killings have been taking place. But in the U.S. press, you barely know what was happening.
Sad but true, absolutely, and I couldn't agree more with your assessment there of those various psyops or what looked to be that way. But returning to the Guantanamo issue, I assume you're going to continue developing this story. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm looking for more information on the two suicides. I spoke to a very well-known pathologist, maybe you've heard of him, Dr. Cyril Wecht, and he examined the autopsies for me. Now, what he found was that anatomically, in terms of what is the information in the autopsies, he could not discount the government's conclusions of suicide. However, at the same time, he could not rule out foul play. That, in essence, he had to only go on what was in those autopsies. But he did say that a number of the facts that I have brought up are very deserving of further investigation and, of course, could change his conclusion depending on what we find out about them. One of them, and one in particular he singled out as being really bad procedure, had to do with the death of the other detainee I didn't speak of here, Muhammad al-Hanashi. Mr. Hanashi had, al-Hanashi, had supposedly strangled himself to death using strips, elastic band from his white briefs, twisting it around his neck and then choking himself to death. One major problem with that is when the autopsy examiners looked at the ligature, they did not actually look at the material, the actual device, in other words, that al-Hanashi had killed himself with. That was not given to they never saw it. They were given a pair of white briefs that were said to be similar by NCIS and then compared the ligature marks on the government-supplied brief. In other words, DOD gave them and said, this is the evidence. You don't have the real evidence. Use this instead. Unfortunately, the government had also let it be known that a year or so earlier, actually 2 years earlier, that the type of underwear they were using at Guantanamo, they were going to make a switch. They were going to switch from the white briefs, and instead they were going to use these really cheap, easily to rip or apart boxers, because they didn't want people using these other kinds of underwear that could be used potentially for suicidal purposes. So in fact, the type of underwear that was mentioned in the autopsy report was not the type of underwear used in the suicide. So where did that come from? So that's one of the number of disturbing things in the case of Mr. Al-Hanashi, who, by the way, should have been on suicide watch. The man, as his autopsy report made clear, had made 5 suicide attempts in the 4 weeks preceding his death. Other detainees who have made even 1 suicide attempt are put under months-long suicide watch and made to wear a special suicide smock. Everything else is taken away from them, and they're kept under constant surveillance. But Al-Hanashi was not found in a suicide smock. He was found in regular detainee clothes. So there are a lot of inconsistencies and very strange circumstances surrounding the death of the other detainee, Al-Hanashi. This is something that Dr. Wecht pointed to as being, you know, bad procedure, and they knew it. They knew that they should have had that original ligature is the term they use for the rope or belt or whatever it is, whatever the device is to use to suffocate yourself or to choke yourself or hang yourself. It's called a ligature, and they did not have that. And there were other facts as well that call into question both these people's deaths. So I've turned to experts, but at a certain point, right now I have Freedom of Information Act requests out for the NCIS investigations into these 2 deaths, and they're in the works, and given the way this government works, especially under Obama these days, I don't know how long it will take for me to get this information, but to a certain extent, it's all so classified that it's very difficult, unless someone comes forward, to penetrate farther into, you know, beyond the kind of documents we already have and ask the questions. And that's why the call for an investigation, both into the 2006 suicides and these 2 suicides, is so important. But unfortunately, the calls for investigation have really gone nowhere.
Well, that's the sad truth. Lies can be exposed, but if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, does it really fall? Does it really happen? And unfortunately, that's exactly what this type of story is like, because it's easy to see the discrepancies, but it's hard to get people to pay attention to them. So I hope people will go to truthout.org and read recently released autopsy reports, Hayden Guantanamo Suicides Mystery. And again, the link will be in the notes for today's interview. And people can stay tuned, I assume, to Truthout for further updates as they become available?
Absolutely. And we are going to continue to cover the Mefloquine issue, and that we have some other surprising new things that might be coming along as well about Guantanamo and, of course, other kinds of related stories.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, and my hat's off to you for keeping your eye on this extremely important story that so many people have taken their eye off of. So, Dr. Jeffrey Kay, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, James.